Chapter 14. The situation, and incredible as it might have appeared to Mr. Stern, he had not yet given up the desire and the hope of inducing that hated old man to stay. Why? There was nothing else to do, unless he were to abandon his chances of fortune. But now, suddenly, since the crossing of the bar at Badu Baru, things seemed to be coming rapidly to a point. It disquieted him so much that the study of the winning numbers failed to soothe his agitation. And the twilight in the cabin deepened, very somber. He put the list away, muttering once more, "Oh, no, my boy, you don't. Not if I know it." He did not mean the blinking, eavesdropping humbug to force his action. He took his head again into his hands. His immobility confined in the darkness of this shut-up little place seemed to make him a thing apart, infinitely removed from the stir and the sounds of the deck. He heard them. The passengers were beginning to jabber excitedly. Somebody dragged a heavy box past his door. He heard Captain Wally's voice above, "Stations, Mr. Stern," and the answer from somewhere on deck forward, "Aye, sir. We shall moor head upstream this time," the ebb was made. "Head upstream, sir. You will see to it, Mr. Stern." The answer was covered by the autocratic clang on the engine room gong. The propeller went on beating slowly. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, with pauses, as if hesitating on the turn. The gong clanged time after time, and the water churned this way and that by the blades, was making a great noisy commotion alongside. Mr. Massey did not move. A shore light on the other bank, a quarter of a mile across the river, drifted, no bigger than a tiny star, passing slowly athwart the circle clear of the port. Voices from Mr. Van Wyck's jetty answered the hails from the ship. Ropes were thrown and missed and thrown again. The swaying flame of a torch carried in a large sampan coming to fetch away in state the Raja from down the coast cast a sudden ruddy glare into his cabin, over his very person. Mr. Massey did not move. After a few last ponderous turns the engine stopped, and the prolonged clanging of the gong signified that the captain had done with them. A great number of boats and canoes of all sizes boarded the offside of the Sofala. Then after a time the tumult of splashing, of cries, of shuffling feet, of packages dropped with a thump, the noise of the native passengers going away, subsided slowly. On the shore, a voice, cultivated, slightly authoritative, spoke very close alongside, "Brought any mail for me this time?" "Yes, Mr. Van Wyck." This was from Stern, and swearing over the rail in a tone of respectful cordiality. "Shall I bring it up to you?" But the voice asked again, "Where's the captain?" "Still on the bridge, I believe. He hasn't left his chair." "Shall I dot?" the voice interrupted negligently. "I will come on board." "Mr. Van Wyck," Stern suddenly broke out with an eager effort, "will you do me the favor?" "Dot." The mate walked away quickly towards the gangway. A silence fell. Mr. Massey in the dark did not move. He did not move, even when he heard slow shuffling footsteps pass his cabin lazily. He contented himself to bellow out through the closed door, "You Jack." The footsteps came back without haste. The door handle rattled, and the second engineer appeared in the opening, shadowy in the sheen of the skylight at his back, with his face apparently as black as the rest of his figure. "We have been very long coming up this time," Mr. Massey growled, without changing his attitude. "What do you expect with half the boiler tubes plugged up for leaks?" The second defended himself loquaciously. "None of your lip," said Massey. "None of your rotten boilers, I say," retorted his faithful subordinate without animation, huskily. "Oh, down there, and carry a head of steam on them yourself if you dare." "I don't." "You aren't worth your salt then," Massey said. The other made a faint noise which resembled a laugh, but might have been a snarl. "Better go slow than stop the ship altogether," he admonished his admired superior. Mr. Massey moved at last. He turned in his chair, and grinding his teeth, "Damn you and the ship. I wish she were at the bottom of the sea. Then you would have to starve. The trusty second engineer closed the door gently. Massey listened. Instead of passing on to the bathroom, where he should have gone to clean himself, the second entered his cabin, which was next door. Mr. Massey jumped up and waited. Suddenly he heard the lock snap in there. He rushed out, and gave a violent kick to the door. "I believe you are locking yourself up to get drunk," he shouted. A muffled answer came after a while. "My own time. If you take to boozing on the trip, I'll fire you out," Massey cried. An obstinate silence followed that threat. Massey moved away perplexed. On the bank, two figures appeared, approaching the gangway. He heard a voice tinged with contempt, "I would rather doubt your word. But I shall certainly speak to him of this." The other voice, Stearns, said with a sort of regretful formality, "Thanks. That's all I want. I must do my duty." Mr. Massey was surprised. A short, dapper figure leaped lightly on the deck, and nearly bounded into him, where he stood beyond the circle of light from the gangway lamp. When it had passed towards the bridge, after exchanging a hurried "good evening," Massey said surlily to Stern, who followed with slow steps, "What is it you're making up to Mr. Van Wyck for now?" "Far from it, Mr. Massey. I am not good enough for Mr. Van Wyck. Neither are you, sir, in his opinion, I am afraid. Captain Wally is, it seems. He's gone to ask him to dine up at the house this evening." Then he murmured to himself darkly, "I hope he will like it." "Zaya, Mr. Van Wyck, the white man of Batu Beru, an ex-naval officer who, for reasons best known to himself, had thrown away the promise of a brilliant career, to become the pioneer of tobacco planting on that remote part of the coast, had learned to like Captain Wally. The appearance of the new skipper had attracted his attention. Nothing more unlike all the diverse types he had seen succeeding each other on the bridge of the Cephala could be imagined. At that time, Batu Beru was not what it has become since. The center of a prosperous tobacco-growing district, a tropically suburban-looking little settlement of bungalows in one long street shaded with two rows of trees, embowered by the flowering and trim luxuriance of the gardens, with a 3-mile-long carriage road for the afternoon drives, and a first-class resident with a fat, cheery wife to lead the society of married estate managers, and unmarried young fellows in the service of the big companies. All this prosperity was not yet, and Mr. Van Wyck prospered alone on the left bank on his deep clearing carved out of the forest, which came down above and below to the water's edge. His lonely bungalow faced across the river the houses of the Sultan, a restless and melancholy old ruler who had done with love and war, for whom life no longer held any savor except of evil forebodings, and time never had any value. He was afraid of death, and hoped he would die before the white men were ready to take his country from him. He crossed the river frequently with never less than 10 boats crammed full of people, in the wistful hope of extracting some information on the subject from his own white man. There was a certain chair on the veranda he always took. The dignitaries of the court squatted on the rugs and skins between the furniture. The inferior people remained below on the grass plot between the house and the river in rows 3 or 4 deep all along the front. Not seldom the visit began at daybreak. Mr. Van Wyck tolerated these inroads. He would nod out of his bedroom window, toothbrush or razor in hand, or pass through the throng of courtiers in his bathing robe. He appeared and disappeared humming a tune, polished his nails with attention, rubbed his shaved face with eau de cologne, drank his early tea, went out to see his coolies at work, returned, looked through some papers on his desk, read a page or two in a book, or sat before his cottage piano leaning back on the stool, his arms extended, fingers on the keys, his body swaying slightly from side to side. When absolutely forced to speak, he gave evasive, vaguely soothing answers out of pure compassion. The same feeling, perhaps, made him so lavishly hospitable with the aerated drinks, that more than once he left himself without soda water for a whole week. that old man had granted him as much land as he cared to have cleared. It was neither more nor less than a fortune. Whether it was fortune or seclusion from his kind that Mr. Van Wyck sought, he could not have pitched upon a better place. Even the mail boats of the subsidized company calling on the various clusters of palm-thatched hovels along the coast steamed past the mouth of Batu Beru River far away in the offing. The contract was old. Perhaps in a few years' time, when it had expired, Batu Beru would be included in the service. Meantime, all Mr. Van Wyck's mail was addressed to Malacca, whence his agent sent it across once a month by the Sofala. It followed that whenever Massey had run short of money through taking too many lottery tickets, or got into a difficulty about a skipper, Mr. Van Wyck was deprived of his letter and newspapers. In so far he had a personal interest in the fortunes of the Sofala. Though he considered himself a hermit and for no passing whim evidently, since he had stood 8 years of it already, he liked to know what went on in the world. Handy on the veranda upon a walnut, edgier it had come last year by the Sofala, everything came by the Sofala, there lay, piled up under bronze weights, a pile of the Times Weekly edition, the large sheets of the Rotterdam Courant, the Graphic in its worldwide green wrappers, an illustrated Dutch publication without a cover, the numbers of a German magazine with covers of the Ismark Malade color. There were also parcels of new music, though the piano it had come years ago by the Sofala in the damp atmosphere of the forests was generally out of tune. It was vexing to be cut off from everything for 60 days at a stretch sometimes, without any means of knowing what was the matter. And when the Sofala reappeared, Mr. Van Wyck would descend the steps of the veranda and stroll over the grass plot in front of his house, down to the waterside, with a frown on his white brow. "You've been laid up after an accident, I presume." He addressed the bridge, but before anybody could answer, Massey was sure to have already scrambled ashore over the rail and pushed in, squeezing the palms of his hands together, bowing his sleek head, as if gummed all over the top with black threads and tapes. And he would be so enraged at the necessity of having to offer such an explanation, that his moaning would be positively pitiful, while all the time he tried to compose his big lips into a smile. "No, Mr. Van Wyck. You would not believe it. I couldn't get one of those wretches to take the ship out. Not a single one of the lazy beasts could be induced, and the law, you know, Mr. Van Wyck." Dot, he moaned at great length apologetically. The words conspiracy, plot, envy, came out prominently, whined with greater energy. Mr. Van Wyck, examining with a faint grimace his polished fingernails, would say, "H'm. Very unfortunate," and turn his back on him. Fastidious, clever, slightly skeptical, accustomed to the best society, he had held a much-envied shore appointment at the Ministry of Marine for a year preceding his retreat from his profession and from Europe. He. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.